Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Glucksmann Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. My name is Dr. Miriam Nighan, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area and worldwide on www.irishradio.com. So whether you're here in New York City, or in Ireland, or somewhere else further afield, sit back and relax agus fáilte isteach. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksmann Ireland House is New York University's Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies. Inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksmann and Loretta Brennan Glucksmann, Glucksmann Ireland House NYU has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since its founding in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. I'm very excited about our opportunity to hear the interview we have today. Every year at Glucksmann Ireland House, NYU, we host the annual Ernie O'Malley Lecture. This lecture series is endowed by Cormac K. H. O'Malley in honour of his father. Ernie O'Malley was an IRA leader who, in his stylistically innovative memoir On Another Man's Wound, published in 1936, integrated modernist technique with revolutionary political history and reinvented what it meant to tell the story of Irish anti-colonial struggle. In October of 2013, to mark the 2013-2014 lecture in honour of Ernie O'Malley, we hosted Professor Elliot J. Gorn of Loyola University, Chicago. He discussed the life of the famous labour leader, Mary Harris, better known to many of us as Mother Jones, who was known as the grandmother of all agitators. In his lecture, Professor Gorn focused specifically on her Irish origins and influences, her life as an American labour organiser, and her recent repatriation back to Ireland. In his book, entitled Mother Jones, The Most Dangerous Woman in America, Gorn puts Jones's past into context as he traces her life through the events of the Irish potato famine, the loss of her husband and children from disease, her attainment of an early education, and the development of her organizing talents that led her to becoming known as an advocate of labor organization in America. Known at the turn of the 20th century as the most dangerous woman in America for her success of organizing mining workers, Jones's history was researched by Gorn with special attention to the portions of her life that had become shrouded in mystery and the many little-known facts about the figure behind the famous words of "Pray for the dead, and fight like hell for the living." Elliot Gorn holds a PhD from Yale University, and his interests include American culture and sports history, particularly centered on the history of various social groups in American urban centers. And he's the author of several books, including Dillinger's Wild Ride, The Year That Made America's Public Enemy Number One, A Brief History of American Sports, and The Manly Art, Bare Knuckle Prize Fighting in America. Mother Jones is a fascinating lens through which we can look at the migration experience. She's born in Cork, by way of Canada, comes down into the United States, and over her long lifetime becomes very well known for her labor agitation, etc., etc. What is interesting, too, is that for a large period of time, she goes relatively unnoticed in an Irish context in terms of being the focus of attention from scholars in Ireland or more general interest in the population at home in Ireland. She follows a similar migration path as the Ford family, who famously end up Ford of Henry Ford and Sons fame. She comes in, they leave Cork, similar to what the Fords do. 1847 is a very important year for the Harris family in the same way as it is for Ford, coming through Canada, down into the United States, etc., etc. There are many parallels and obviously then many divergences in terms of how their lives evolve. We'll hear a fascinating critique and survey of the life of Mother Jones, how she has been portrayed in history, how she portrayed herself, how she's been remembered or misremembered or a failure to remember in some cases as well. Professor Gorn had a wonderful delivery, clearly was very and is very sensitive to the intricacies of her life as a whole. And it's one of the wonderful opportunities presented as part of the public event series at Luxman Ireland House to have the opportunity to hear wonderful lectures like these and insights into the lives of Irish Americans. Mother Jones is a fantastic example of the connections between Ireland and the United States in that context. So this is a live recording of the public lecture given in October 2013. Sit back and enjoy Professor Elliot Gorn on Mother Jones.
It is interesting how, you know, when you start talking about Mother Jones, you start telling stories. And I won't tell too many, but for example, not too long, actually, I'd actually finished the book, finished writing the book. It wasn't out yet. And I was in southern Colorado, in Pueblo, Colorado, one of the places where she organized coal miners. And I went into, there's a small prison in town, actually, that was made into the Historical Society. And Mother Jones had actually been incarcerated in that prison during the Great Colorado Coal Strike in 1912, what resulted in finally the Ludlow Massacre. And there was a very old woman who was running the museum, and I mentioned that I had just finished a book about Mother Jones. And she says, Mother Jones, she said, I dress up as Mother Jones and play her in the schools. And then she pointed to her husband, who was much older and more decrepit than she was. I apologize. And she says, his mother heard Mother Jones speak from a railroad car just outside this building, just out there. She said she never heard a woman swear so much. So that's what we're dealing with. Now, if I were a preacher, I would need a text for my sermon, and I would take, for this sermon, a line from Kris Kristofferson's wonderful song, Me and Bobby McGee, the line we all know, freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. And I think by the end you'll agree that could have been Mother Jones's motto. One other thing I want to mention. A friend of mine teaches at NYU, Jeffrey Sammons, I don't know if you know him, but we were talking on email about something else, and my new project, and I said, well, I don't really know that I'm up to it or that I know enough and that sort of thing, and he paraphrased W.E.B. Du Bois saying that the most important thing in any project like this is sensitivity to the subject is the key to understanding, not identity or experience or training. And I'm going to ask you to indulge that because I'm not Irish, and really Irish studies is not my field per se. But then I did write this book about Mother Jones. What I'm going to do is try to give you a sense of who she is and then try to give you a sense, try to evoke why I think she is who she is. In other words, first tell you who she was as Mother Jones, and then try to talk a little bit about her early life. Begin with, this microphone is tough, but begin with a quote. There broke out a storm of applause, which swelled into a tumult, as a little woman came forward on the platform. This is the great labor novelist Upton Sinclair writing. She was wrinkled and old, dressed in black, looking like somebody's grandmother. She was, in truth, the grandmother of hundreds of thousands of miners. Now, Sinclair's classic novel, 1906 novel, The Jungle, about life and labor in Chicago's stockyards, he now turned his attention to the Colorado coal wars. Again, quoting Upton Sinclair, hearing her speak, this is 1913, you discovered the secret of her influence over these polyglot hordes. She had force, she had wit. Above all, she had the fire of indignation. She was the walking wrath of God. And he went on. Mother Jones would tell endless stories about her adventures, about strikes she had led, speeches she'd made, interviews with presidents and governors and captains of industry, jails and convict camps. All over the world she'd roamed, and wherever she went, the flame of protest leaped in the hearts of men. Her story was a veritable odyssey of revolt. these photos, these pictures are a little random, but they'll sort of fill in. And well, Sinclair's words were literally true. For 25 years, from the late 1890s to the early 1920s, this elderly woman had no home. As she explained to a congressional committee when asked where she lived, quote, "My address is like my shoes. It follows me wherever I go." She wore antique black dresses, exaggerated her age, spoke of her impending mortality, her impending death, and invoked a mother's claim to moral virtue. But she merged her saintly image with hellfire oratory and raw physical courage. She defied police officers, private detectives, National Guardsmen. She flouted judges' injunctions, belittled governors, and assailed businessmen. She served several jail terms, declaring she could raise more hell inside prison than out. When I say that about governors and businessmen, the governor during the mine war in West Virginia was a man named Glasscock, who she insisted on referring to as Crystal Peter. And John D. Rockefeller, the man of the oil fortune, who of course is a hero in America, she persistently referred to as Oily John. Well, so who was Mother Jones? With organized labor's declining fortunes in the 21st century, we don't hear of her so much anymore, except for a progressive magazine named in her honor and her famous battle cry, "Pray for the dead and fight like hell for the living." She's a faded memory. Yet she was one of the most famous women in America during the first decades of the 20th century. John Brophy, who later became a United Mine Workers official, first met her when he was a young miner at the turn of the century. I'm quoting Brophy here. "She came into the mine one day and talked to us in our workplace in the vernacular of the mines. How she got in, I don't know. She probably just walked in and defied anyone to stop her. She would take a drink with the boys and spoke their idiom, including some pretty rough language when she was talking about the bosses. This might have been considered a little fast in ordinary women, but the miners knew and respected her. They knew she was a good soul and a friend of those who lacked friends." Like Upton Sinclair, Brophy noted Mother Jones' oratorical powers, how her voice didn't rise with drama, the drama of her stories, but dropped in pitch and intensity, so that it became, quote, "something you could almost feel physically." Now, it was her passion that moved men and women. To the many immigrant workers who didn't understand her every word, she made her feelings clear through what Brophy called gestures and French classics, which is to say, swearing. And above all, she embodied courage. And again, I'm quoting John Brophy. Quote, "She had a complete disregard for danger or hardship and would go in wherever she thought she was needed. And she cared no more about approval from union leaders than operators, the mine owners. Wherever people were in trouble, she showed up to lead the fight with tireless devotion. Introduced once as a great humanitarian, Mother Jones snapped, get it straight, I'm not a humanitarian, I'm a hellraiser." There were famous contemporaries in her era who knew and loved her. "She's a wonder," the poet Carl Sandburg wrote during World War I. "Close to 88 years old, and her voice a singing voice. Nobody else could give me a thrill just by saying in that slow, solemn, monotone way, the Kaisers of this country are next, I tell you." Clarence Darrow, America's most famous trial lawyer, probably in the 20th century, wrote of her, and they were friends, very good friends. Quote, "Her deep convictions and fearless soul always drew her to seek the spot where the fight was hottest and the danger greatest." The feminist writer, Mary Delasour, was only 14 years old when she first heard Mother Jones speak, but she never forgot it. Quote, "I felt engendered by the true mother, not the private mother of one family, but the emboldened and blazing defender of all of her sons and daughters." In her 60s, 70s, and 80s, Mother Jones renounced friends, family, and possessions to live on the road with her people. And out of that commitment grew working families' powerful sense of identification with her. Hearing that she'd been arrested in Colorado during the mine wars, a worker named T.J. Llewellyn, from Missouri, wrote to the Secretary of Labor, quote, "I've carried a gun three times in the industrial wars of this country, and by the eternal, if any harm comes to the old mother, I'm not too old, nor by the same token too cowardly to carry it again." A woman, Margaret Duvall from Kentucky, warned of an aroused working class as she said, quote, "More dreadful than this country has ever seen should any harm come to Mother Jones." And A. Van Tassel from Ohio
then-President Woodrow Wilson in a letter to Free the Miner's Angel. Quote, this beautiful hero of the labor movement has committed no crime, but is being slowly murdered because she insisted on agitating and educating the workers to realize their true status in society. Just to give you a sense of what she evoked in people. Mother Jones organized workers' wives into boisterous demonstrations. She cajoled and browbeat union men to stay true to their organizations. She would tell them that if they were too afraid to organize and strike, that they were unfit to have women live with them. As Mother Jones, she spoke for the family of labor with deep moral authority. Her speeches rejected the untrammeled rule of the marketplace and upheld instead an ideal of humane communities of working families. She invoked wrenching images of blood stolen, bodies mangled, youth exploited, to dramatize the injustice of poverty in America. Above all, she gave working people hope and told them their collective aspirations were in the best traditions of American freedom. These were hard times for American workers. Coal was America's fuel, and 750,000 men mined it. They were paid roughly $400 a year, often in company scrip, which forced them to live in company towns and buy goods at the company store, where private armed guards routinely abrogated their civil liberties. Another 500,000 American men were steelworkers, labored for 12-hour shifts 6 days a week. Millions of women and children worked in mills and sweatshops for pennies, often with little choice but to work or starve. I forget I've got this. We'll talk about that. Mother Jones was one of many radicals of her era, including Socialist Party leader Eugene V. Debs, anarchist Emma Goldman, champion of black freedom W.E.B. Du Bois, communitarian journalist Julius Wayland, industrial workers of the world organizer Big Bill Haywood. All responded to the crushing weight of corporate power by mobilizing Americans with new ideas, unions, syndicalist organizations, political parties, even to the point of open rebellion. Mother Jones, too, was at the center of these radical, often violent times. She worked more for the United Mine Workers than any other organization, especially in the early days when it was the largest industrial union in America. She organized anthracite workers, miners in Pennsylvania, bituminous workers in the Middle West Central competitive field, but she broke with the United Mine Workers leadership as it turned more conservative early in the 20th century. In 1903, she organized a protest against child labor, the famous March of the Mill Children, from Philadelphia to President Theodore Roosevelt's summer home on Long Island. Just a few images of miners. She would just go down there when they allowed her to, when they didn't stop her. Between 1905 and 1912, she went out on the road organizing for the Socialist Party and for the Radical Western Federation of Miners. She was the founding mother of the Industrial Workers of the World and a signer of that group's original charter. She organized copper miners in Calumet, brewery workers in Milwaukee, garment workers in Chicago. She rejoined the United Mine Workers as a paid organizer around 1912, just as it launched two massive efforts that turned violent in West Virginia and Colorado. Quoting her, medieval West Virginia, with its tent colonies on the bleak hills, with its grim men and women, when I get to the other side, I shall tell God Almighty about West Virginia. Obviously, she didn't win all of these strikes. She was the most prominent and successful organizer for the United Mine Workers, which in the early 20th century was America's largest and most successful industrial union. But we miss her larger importance if we focus only on the nuts and bolts of daily organizing. Mother Jones, above all, captured the spirit of the labor movement in that era and of the American left. She had, as I say, a gift for words. Thrown into prison once again during the Colorado strike, she told reporters, I can raise more hell in prison than out. Once a man in jail told her that he was serving time for stealing a pair of shoes. She replied that he should have stolen a railroad. Then he'd be a United States senator. Some things change. Reminded of Jesus' self-abnegation, Mother Jones declared, Christ himself would agitate against the plutocrats and hypocrites who tell the workers to go down on their knees and get right with God. Christ, the carpenter's son, would tell them to stand up on their feet and fight for righteousness and justice on the earth. She traveled thousands and thousands of miles by rail and car and horse-drawn carriages and on foot, giving hundreds of speeches across America. She really is the Johnny Appleseed of organizers in this era. In the 19-teens, she worked with Mexican revolutionaries in the Southwest, political prisoners in California, steel workers in the Midwest. In the 20s, the 1920s found her back in the coal fields, but now in her mid-80s. Her health was starting to break down, and her great oratorical powers were flagging. She continued making some appearances, and she worked on her autobiography, which appeared in 1925. On May Day, as Marion showed you, 1930, she and hundreds of well-wishers celebrated her 100th birthday. And I want to say that I think the best line in my book, which makes an excellent present, by the way, that the best line in the book is, Mother Jones was 93 years old on the day she celebrated her 100th birthday. Six months later, she passed away after her birthday. They buried Mother Jones in the Union Miners Cemetery in Mount Olive, Illinois, alongside, as she said, the brave boys who died in labor's cause. This is a cemetery that's still there down in Mount Olive near St. Louis, right on the highway, about an hour north of St. Louis. Still the only, I believe, cemetery in America that's owned by a labor union. In the story of Mount Olive was that these miners who were killed in a strike were not allowed to be buried in any of the cemeteries in the area. They were forbidden from being buried there. So the union bought a patch of land and created this cemetery. It's quite a lovely place. Thousands of people came to hear Father John McGuire's funeral oration, and tens of thousands of more listened on radio station WCFL, Chicago's Voice of Labor. Today, McGuire said, in gorgeous mahogany furnished and carefully guarded offices in distant capitals, wealthy mine owners and capitalists are breathing sighs of relief. Today, upon the plains of Illinois, the hillsides and valleys of Pennsylvania and West Virginia, in California, Colorado, and British Columbia, strong men and toil-worn women are weeping tears of bitter grief. The reasons are the same. Mother Jones is dead. For working men and women, Mother Jones was one of their own. She organized thousands of workers, as I say, in a range of trades, but perhaps her greatest achievement was being heard at all. For who was more silenced in early 20th century America than an elderly, working-class, immigrant widow? Well, this is all very interesting, right? But the fact is, there was no Mother Jones. Or to put it more precisely, Mother Jones was a persona created by a woman named Mary Jones, whose given name at birth was Mary Harris. And it took me a long time to figure this out. I'm kind of slow sometimes. To conceptualize it this way, but it's important. Well, in that case, who was Mary Harris? Who was Mary Jones? She did write, as I showed you, an autobiography, and here are the opening words of that autobiography. I was born in the city of Cork, Ireland in 1830. My people were poor. For generations, they fought for Ireland's freedom. Many of my folks have died in that struggle. My father, Richard Harris, came to America in 1835, and as soon as he had become an American citizen, he sent for his family. That's it. That's almost her entire treatment of her childhood, these five short sentences. Now, note what she doesn't say. Her mother's name, her siblings, where she went to school, if she was baptized, if they spoke Irish, if the family attended church, how they made a living. In a book of 250 pages, she devoted six to the first half of her life, 50 years nominally. And much of what she wrote in all of these pages was wrong. The autobiography of Mother Jones was written in 1925, when according to her calculation, she was 95 years old. So maybe this is an instance of her simply not remembering very well. She is very old. And then, too, she grew up in a less publicly confessional times than our own. So maybe her reticence was part of the spirit of that age. I should say it was co-written by a woman named Mary Field Parton, a social worker and friend of Mother Jones, who was also at one time the mistress of Clarence Darrow. So there's, again, it's all connected. Well, above all, the autobiography was meant less, I think, to reveal Mary Harris or Mary Jones's life than to inspire others to action, to perpetuate the memory of Mother Jones. Mary Jones was not the sort of person for whom much biographical information is available. The poor don't usually write and keep too many letters. They rarely publish memoirs. Archives in the past were not much interested in whatever papers they might leave behind. So if Mother Jones was not particularly interested that we get to know her early life, and if there isn't a whole lot of other evidence to go on, how do we say anything about her? Well, historians know how to do this. You work with the bits and pieces that you do find, that you can find, and you massage it. For example, she was already quite famous. When she was already quite famous, she gave her birth date as May Day, 1830, right? She said this in interviews. She remembered her 100th birthday. She said it in speeches. She repeated it in the autobiography. But the very first newspaper stories about her back in the late 19th century said she was born in the late 1830s. And as it turns out, research in Irish parish records gives a baptismal date of August 1st, 1837. And of course, Irish baptism usually follows birth very, 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 very quickly. So she exaggerated her age by 7 years. Why would she do that? Well, to enhance her venerability, to make her story more remarkable, to be able to say to workers, if a 90-year-old woman can be out here risking all, you can too. She clearly did that. It's quite clear that sometime around the very early 19th century, that's when she starts talking about May Day, the workers' holiday, being her birthday, 1830 being that the year she's born. Before that, she was vague about it in the late 1830s. Well, here's what we do know. Richard Harris and Ellen Cotter were married in the tiny town of Inchegila, County Cork, on February 9, 1834. The firstborn son was baptized in Inchegila Parish. Mary came next, and she and the rest of the Harris children were baptized in the North Cathedral in the city of Cork. Probably the family had moved to Cork for work for Richard, though Inchegila Parish was only 30 miles distant, connected by the River Lee and a carriage road. Inchegila is a patch of land about 6 by 9 miles, containing then about 6,000 people. And a contemporary described it, the parish, as, quote, a country gradually assuming wilder and more imposing features. Everywhere it's broken up by rocky hills, partially clothed with purple heath and firs. Slight patches of cultivation diversify the succession of crag and heath, snatches it would seem, from the surrounding barrenness. It really does have a wild, even till today, a real wild quality to it. It's really very beautiful, much of it. The population of Ireland was growing rapidly in these years, and in rural parishes, land was divided and subdivided into tiny farms for which landlords often charged exorbitant rents. Most families got by on potatoes, supplemented, when possible, with milk from a dairy cow. Yet Ireland's was no subsistence economy. Commerce had penetrated everywhere. The cities were marketplaces for goods from the hinterlands. But Inchegila Parish was a little more remote than most, a little poorer, with a lower literacy rate. One was more likely to hear Irish spoken there than other parts of the country. It also had a strong history of rebellion, of Rockite, Molly Maguire, and white boy outrages, as the English called them, kept alive in local legends and ballads. When I was there, when I was first starting to work on this book, and I was visiting Inchegila and Cork and Dublin, and a sort of local historian, unofficial historian, Peter O'Leary, sang a song called The Battle of Kaimani, which commemorated a Rockite battle that took place in the 1820s. And he just sang it from memory. It was quite remarkable. The Harris children no doubt carried much of the culture of the rural parish with them, but they were raised mostly in Cork, in the city. And here too, like elsewhere in Ireland, commerce expanded through the 1840s, while wealth was concentrated in relatively very few hands. Even before the famine, many Irish people faced poverty or emigration. And to a large extent, the skew in wealth coincided with religion. Catholics like the Harrises tended to be the losers in this race. Mother Jones described her father as a laborer, and perhaps we can never know. He worked at the famous Cork Butter Market, since the family lived nearby, in North Cork. Most Irish dairy products, beef and pork, bound for North America, were shipped out of Cork Harbor, offering lots of work in packing, crating, and hauling. for men. Again, we can only speculate on the quality of life for young Mary Harris, but just imagining North Cork, we can conjure the sight of the poor wandering the streets, of the hospitals and asylums in that part of town, the pungent smells of the limeworks and the local tannery, the offal from hundreds of pack animals bringing goods in from the countryside, the sounds of straining men hauling goods from the butter market down to the River Lee, and the sounds, too, of the famous bells of Shandon from the Church of Ireland House of Worship. Cork of Mary's youth was a poor town, with 80,000 residents, most of them in the slums. Wages had been stagnant for decades as more and more people poured in from the rural parishes. Politics were volatile, with cross-cutting schisms along lines of class, religion, and nationalism. Here, Daniel O'Connell held monster rallies for repeal of the hated Act of Union. Here, too, was alleged that the original North Cathedral was burned down by Protestants. And Catholics came very close to retaliating against St. Anne's Shandon Church, prevented, it was said, only by a priestly intervention. But what Mother Jones claims, made much later in life that she witnessed severed heads at the ends of bayonets and that her father fled for his life because of his revolutionary activities against the hated English? It all seems pretty unlikely. Richard Harris's name shows up in no official record that I was able to find, nor was Cork the sort of place where rebel heads bled into the streets, not during Mary Harris's youth. Perhaps some distant kin were involved in secret societies that flourished in the Southwest, including parishes like Inchegila, and maybe the Harrises told stories about them as part of family lore. If Richard was involved, he escaped notice by the authorities. Now, many Irish immigrants later told stories of rebellious kin who resisted the English and were forced to flee. But for most exiles in the late 1840s and early 50s, there was another reason why they left Ireland, and it applied to the Harris family as well. They were famine immigrants. The story of the Great Hunger is well known. In a country of a little over 8 million people, 1 million perished of starvation and disease in the late 40s and early 50s. Another 2 million left Ireland for good, bound for England, Australia, and North America. As potatoes rotted in the fields, landlords backed by the government simply pushed poor tenants off their estates. London responded with aid, but hardly enough. Political conservatives and evangelical Protestants continued to lecture the Irish about their slothfulness and their fecklessness and their supernatural religion. Some saw divine judgment, others a good lesson in thrift. The old saying that God created the potato blight, but the English made the famine, has more than a kernel of truth in it. Mass hunger could not have been wholly prevented, and England didn't cause this Holocaust, but rigid belief by many officials in laissez-faire ideology, in the justice of markets, the laziness of the poor, and the virtue of the rich, prevented relief measures that might have saved countless lives. Why do I feel like I just went through that in the last couple of weeks? Anyway. Sorry. Mary Harris was 10 years old when her father and eldest brother left for Canada. The Harris men went over in 1847, probably the darkest year of the famine, when the coffin ships brought most of the exiles into Canada, not the United States. For 4 or 5 more years, Mary would witness the poor coming into Cork, looking for food, looking for a way out, looking for a place to die. City streets became breeding grounds for all of the diseases of the countryside: typhus, scurvy, relapsing fever, dysentery. There was little food left in the city, and how her mother, Ellen Harris, kept the family together for the next 4 years really is a mystery. Finally, Richard Harris was able to send for his family, and they all arrived in Toronto early in the 1850s. So no, Mary's people probably did not leave fighting for Ireland's freedom. Yet she did take with her ideas about justice and injustice. She learned from the famine an awareness of herself and her family as the poor. And she left, too, with stories of martyrs who fought the oppressors, and she imbibed deep resentment against the greedy ones who pillaged their land and drove them out. Mary Harris left her ancestral homeland around the age of 15. She never spoke much about the terror and sadness of these formative years, but memories of Ireland, especially of the Great Hunger, stayed with her and shaped her views in later decades. This was especially true since she now grew to adulthood in a town that had a very large Irish population, both Protestant and Catholic, and the latter community was very active with in parish organizing. The Harris family lived in a respectable working-class section of Toronto, heavily but not exclusively Irish. We know that the family was active in the church, that the children mostly went to Catholic schools, that Mary's youngest brother, William, studied for the priesthood, and that when she needed a character reference to enter the teacher's college, she turned to her parish priest. This was an era of powerful institution building in the Toronto diocese, with new churches, orphanages, schools, even a broad-based temperance crusade patterned after that of Father Theobald Matthew back in Ireland, and all of it rather successful at bringing the new immigrants into the fold, giving them a cradle-to-grave culture, but also sparking renewed assaults on the church by Protestants as a despotic institution. Toronto in the 1850s was a turbulent place. I know we don't think of Canada that way. I understand. My father was from Montreal and, you know, Canadian. So. The economy boomed with new construction, attracting large numbers of newcomers. Mother Jones used to say that she first learned of the clash of capital and labor when a boss tried to cheat her father out of his wages. She said that she literally went to the boss and demanded that he pay up. Probably not true. But there surely was plenty of labor conflict in these years, with alternate inflation and recession, violence and intimidation accompanied efforts of labor organizing. And Richard Harris, who worked on the railroads in Canada, could have heard easily enough his fellow workers organizing declare, and this is a quote, "Are we to be trampled under the feet of despotic, dollar-hunting railroad contractors? Freedom says no. Common sense and public opinion echo no." There was plenty of sectarian conflict, too. Known as the Belfast of North America, Toronto was a third Irish, but with a very large Protestant population. Orangemen were longer established in town than most Catholic Irish. They used their ties to conservative politicians to have greater access to jobs in the police force and in public works. In the famine years and after, prejudice was right on the surface. The Toronto Globe declared, quote, "The monstrous delusion of Catholicism to be the enemy of the human race. Rome's goal," the editor wrote, "was the subversion of religious and civil liberty." The Globe added that the sloth, filth, and drunkenness of the famine Irish made them a plague to Canada West, like the locusts of Egypt. Irish Catholics responded to such sentiments with organizing of their own, from the Hibernian Benevolence Society to the Fenian Movement, and there aren't hints that Richard Harris was involved with that movement. In any event, Irish nationalism and Irish Catholic assertiveness were very much in the air as Mary Harris grew to adulthood. And so was longing for the old country, as songs like "My Inchigeela Lass" and "Remember Skibbereen" rang out in homes and pubs. Of course, as the eldest daughter, Mary Harris must have shouldered many of the household responsibilities in Cork and Toronto, cleaning and cooking, caring for the young ones, shopping, washing the clothes. She became so proficient with a needle and thread that later in life she earned her bread as a seamstress and dressmaker. But she was ambitious to learn. At the age of 20, in 1857, she gained admission to the Toronto Normal School, the crown jewel of pedagogy in Canada West. The school's mission was to train teachers, but also to spread British bourgeois culture through Canada's western territories. There were very, very few Irish students when she entered. She was one of only two Catholics in the whole school, and the only one who was a woman. She never finished her education. She must have been very uncomfortable there. But she stayed for almost a year. She had enough training to secure a position. Teaching, of course, was one of the few careers open to women, and she landed a job teaching at a convent school in Monroe, Michigan, in 1859. She was 22 years old. So her baggage included ideas and feelings and memories from Ireland and now Canada. Her family's saga was part of a much larger story of poor people in Europe and America caught up in a booming capitalist marketplace. In Cork, she witnessed the most abject misery firsthand, years of it. And there, too, she developed a way of thinking about oppression, of personalizing its origins and glorifying the martyrs who resisted it. In Toronto, she was exposed to the vagaries of working-class life in an industrializing city, to labor struggles, to the church's teachings about the need for womanly renunciation in the name of Mother Mary, and to the heady rhetoric of freeing Ireland from the English oppressors. All of this she took to the United States. We don't know why she left her home and family, if there was some rift between them, or if she merely wanted to see the world, or if this was just her ambition speaking. We know that Irish women were unusually adventurous, that compared to other immigrants, they often traveled and sought work while unmarried and alone. So there was nothing that unusual about her venturing off. She truly was footloose for a little while. She didn't stay but a few months in Monroe, Michigan, traveled from there to the booming western city of Chicago, where she opened a dressmaking shop. But less than a year later, on the eve of the American Civil War, as it turned out, she took a teaching job, another teaching job, in Memphis, Tennessee. That didn't last that long either. She met and married a man named George Jones, not the singer, the country singer. Memphis was a boomtown on the eve of the Civil War, a key city for the packing, weighing, and shipping of cotton. Four railroads converged on the bluff city. Two more were under construction, and the town grew in no small part because of immigration, with over 4,000 Irish immigrants by 1860. The Irish were poor enough to compete with the black population, both slave and free, for jobs, and they settled primarily in the First Ward, a neighborhood known as Pinch, short for Pinch Gut, because of the leanness of its denizens. You know, you can pinch your gut, there's nothing there. There, in Pinch, Mary and Jones made their home. They survived secession, the siege of Memphis, emancipation, and a terrible race riot in 1860 in which Irish immigrants participated in large numbers against the newly freed slaves, killing 46 blacks, shooting, beating, and raping 200 more, burning 89 homes, 4 churches, 12 schoolhouses, all of it a prelude to the violent intimidation that the Ku Klux Klan, founded by Memphian Nathan Bedford Forrest, would bring against the freedmen beginning in 1867. In these turbulent times, Mary and George Jones started a family. And by 1867, when Mary was 30 years old, they had 4 children, according to the autobiography. As a school teacher, she had attained really the top of the occupational pyramid for Irish women. As was expected of women with children of this era, of course, she quit her job to raise them. George, though, was part of what later years would be called the aristocracy of labor. A skilled worker, a union man, an iron molder, in an era when there was high demand for heavy industrial goods, boilers, rails, freight cars, and the like, especially with war. If Mary had witnessed workplace disputes involving her father in Toronto, here was her first encounter with organized labor, as she and George spoke about the nascent union movement, and as they read the Iron Workers International Journal that came into the home each month. So Mary Jones had come a long way from the dire scene she witnessed in the streets of Cork. Tragedy, though, was about to strike again. The Joneses' neighborhood, the Pinch, was in a low-lying part of town, always susceptible to flooding, and in fall to seasonal outbreaks of disease. In early September of 1867, yellow fever appeared once again along the Gulf Coast, and by the end of the month, it had made its way up the Mississippi River. Through October, it had its way with Memphis. Statistics are very hard to come by. Something like 2,500 people fell ill. Epidemics are never socially neutral. As had been the custom, the rich fled the city at the first signs of outbreak. Yellow fever was often referred to as stranger's disease because newcomers like the Irish had no previous exposure to it and therefore little immunity. Those stricken with yellow fever first developed flu-like symptoms, but within a few days they were hemorrhaging literally from every orifice, vomiting black blood, and dying in agony. All 4 of Mary Jones' children died. So did George Jones. The matter-of-fact tone of the autobiography only heightens the emotion. I'm quoting her. In 1867, a yellow fever epidemic swept Memphis. Across the street from me, 10 persons lay dead from the plague. The dead surrounded us. They were buried at night quickly and without ceremony. All about my house, I could hear weeping and the cries of delirium. One by one, my 4 little children sickened and died. I washed their little bodies and got them ready for burial. My husband caught the fever and died. I sat alone through nights of grief. No one came to me. No one could. Other homes were as stricken as mine. All day long, all night long, I heard the grating of the wheels of the death cart. So first the death cart's wheels in Cork, then resurrection from those horrors, and now that sound again, death carts, real or imagined, bearing away her family. After a short time, we don't know how long, weeks or months, she left for Chicago. Now, This was in 1867, and she managed to start a dressmaking shop in Chicago again with a partner. Any of you know your Chicago history? What great tragedy, not the Chicago Cubs, happened? In 1871, they're burned out of their shop. She, like a quarter of a million, well, there's 300,000 people in the city at that time. 100,000 of them are left homeless. She's one of them, fleeing the fire, heading to Lake Michigan to basically just escape the flames. So once again, famine, plague, and fire. It's biblical. Well, from this point, as she describes, the autobiography makes an abrupt turn for several pages. We learn of a series of events, the Great Railroad Strike of 1877, the hanging of the Haymarket Martyrs. These are all important in Chicago history and in American history. The hangings in 1886, the Pullman Strike in 1894. She describes herself as both an eyewitness and participant in all of these. Yet the descriptions are not terribly detailed, and there's no outside evidence of her participation. You read them and you know you could be reading someone else's description. There's nothing that brings her into it. She's there, clearly, and she was there, but exactly as a participant, who knows? Mostly, I think, these three decades were her years in the wilderness, working, trying to make a living, trying to put the horrors of her past behind her, and yeah, at the same time, imbibing radical and laborite ideas, going to lectures, as she says. Though, of course, the left, the American left, was far less hospitable to women than to men. Chicago, though, was the most radical city in America in this era. It was the crucible where events of the first 30 years of Mother Jones's life mixed in her imagination, I think, with the great national dramas of immigration, the building of the enormous fortunes, a city rising before people's eyes, massive industries, worker rebellion against oppression. Here she got to know many of the nation's union leaders, a group that was heavily Irish and Irish-American. And it was in Chicago that she created Mother Jones. For it was in Chicago, the great shock city of the late 19th century, that people came to change their luck, change their lives, change their identities. She'd witnessed an unspeakable tragedy in Ireland, lived amidst it for years before finally fleeing, and then came the tragedy of losing her family, and then the fire, famine, plague, and fire. In Chicago, she simply buried that past, put it behind her, almost never spoke of it for the rest of her life. She became someone else. She buried Mary Harris and Mary Jones and became Mother Jones, heroine of a thousand battles for workers everywhere. As Mother Jones, she tailored her appearance to match every sentimental notion of motherhood, the old-fashioned dresses with bits of lace and the saintly demeanor. More, she was a woman who'd suffered and grown old, which in some sense made her safe. But she did not, as women were expected to do, suffer quietly, stay silent. She subverted the very idea of genteel womanhood on which such stereotypes were based with her vituperative, profane, electric speeches. Women, especially old women, were not supposed to have opinions about politics and economics. They were not supposed to travel alone. They were too delicate for controversy. Well, there she was, haranguing workers, berating politicians, attacking the pirates, as she called capitalists, telling men and women to take to the streets all under the cover of sacred motherhood. It was her lived experience of class in Cork and Toronto and Memphis and Chicago that gave her insight into the suffering of working families. And it was her insistence on speaking for the poor, not as an outsider, but as one of them, that made her so beloved. She was Mother Mary, interceding on their behalf. And she did this by creating Mother Jones, then living that persona for over 30 years. Without the mask of Mother Jones, who was she? A common woman whose early years yielded toil and tragedy, whose old age promised nothing but obscurity. She was expected to go silently through life. For she was a mere worker in a country that worshipped success, an immigrant in a nativist land, a woman in a male-dominated society, and an elderly person in a nation that cherished youth. Hers was a voice that Americans were not supposed to hear. And that was her legacy. Out of nothing but courage and passion and commitment, she created a unique voice, a prophetic voice, and raised it in the cause of renewing America's democratic promise. Now, as I said, Mother Jones became quite famous between roughly 1900, a little before 1900, and the early 1920s. Yet even when her fame was at its peak, there's no record that she was known in Ireland that I've found. When she died in 1930, the tiniest notice appeared on the inside page of the Cork Examiner under the heading, Cork Centenarian Dies in USA. So far as we know, she never returned to Ireland, and she's been long forgotten there, until a couple years ago. How should I tell this? I published the book on Mother Jones in 2001. I'd been to Ireland to do research there and went back since and found no awareness particularly of her existence in Inchigila or Cork or Dublin at the archives. But out of the blue in 2012, just a year ago, a little over a year ago, I got an email from a man named Gerard O'Mahony in Cork telling me that the city was planning a celebration centered around the day of her baptism, August 1st. He also sent a note to Professor Rosemary Fuhrer at Northern Illinois University, who'd made a half-hour documentary about Mother Jones' life and has been organizing various labor sites in downstate Illinois. And also he sent a note to Merritt Moore, a former miner, novelist, and organizer of the Daughters of Mother Jones, who were active in the Pittston coal strike of 1989, and also to a woman named Kailani Lee, an actress in residence at George Mason University in Washington, who wrote and performed a play about Mother Jones' life. By spring, we had all committed to going to Ireland. Now, Gerard O'Mahony is a lifelong citizen of Cork, except for a couple of years when he was living in the States. In fact, it was in New York City that he first heard of Mother Jones, from a guy he worked with in Harlem, who described her as a, quote, great woman from Cork, whom this other man's grandfather had met during a strike. Well, O'Mahony was intrigued by this, contacted Mother Jones magazine to find out more about her. They were not very helpful, but the idea wouldn't go away. Now, very recently, one Cork city councilman, Tim Tynan, who had been active in the trade union movement, had urged that she be commemorated with a plaque in Cork City, where she grew up. Jer spoke about Mother Jones to some of his friends, local merchants, tradesmen, civil servants, and they began to read about her. And they joined forces with Tynan and started an informal organization to revive her memory in Cork. I mean, I'm sorry I'm behind, but it's important here. As I say, she organized child laborers, and these are wonderful, mostly Lewis Hine photographs from that era. This is where the March of the Mill Children began in Philadelphia. And that's her burial spot, her tombstone in Mount Olive, Illinois. There you go. Mother Mary. I mean, you can't make this up. But this is what I wanted to get to. Can you read that or no? The Spirit of Mother Jones Festival, pray for the dead and fight like hell for the living. The Spirit of Mother Jones Festival honors, H-O-N-O-U-R-S, not America, the memory of Cork-born Mary Harris known as Mother Jones. Mother Jones was an inspirational woman in the early 20th century who campaigned fearlessly for the workers and union rights and who fought courageously for social justice in America. The festival celebrates Mother Jones through an annual series of events in Shandon around 1st of August. It promotes the ongoing relevance of her life and work and celebrates the efforts of ordinary people everywhere in their quest for truth and social justice. And there's her plaque on John Redmond Street in the Shandon area of North Cork. And here she is. I just want to read to you a little bit. I deliberately, and then just this year again, the second annual Mother Jones Festival in Cork, there'll be one next year. It'll be a good time to go to Cork. I had deliberately gone out of my way, since Gerard O'Mahony was the prime moving force in this, and there are others in town. It was great to meet everyone. They're just folks. They just thought this would be, she's a wonderful Cork woman, and we should celebrate her. Some of them are, you know, trade unionists and political leftists. Many of them are not at all. It's a very, very eclectic group. But she is a Cork woman, and above all, she captures the spirit of this place, people felt. So I'd emailed back and forth with Jer a little bit just to get him to write me a little bit. What was he thinking? What was he up to? He's thinking about the upcoming, the 2013 festival. For 2013, there was little point in, again, honoring a dead woman. We wanted to honor the living spirit of Mother Jones, that passion, that commitment, that work that Mother Jones brought to her causes, and which continues from those fighting the good fight all across the world to this day. The exploitation hasn't stopped, the injustice hasn't gone away, and those who are being subjected to injustice and exploitation very often have no voice in their own countries or elsewhere. Mother Jones was forgotten, so were so many others in history, and we wanted to bring some of these to public attention. Tag Barry, the Cork lockout. In addition, we also wanted to further knowledge of Mother Jones herself. In this age of austerity, Mother Jones and her quaint idea of the attainment of, quote, a grander civilization by labor was an idea whose time had arrived. And she was and is very relevant, a woman overcoming all her personal obstacles, misfortune, tragedy, starting her political life at an age when we expect to retire, and her fearless devotion to ordinary people until she passed away is a lesson we can learn from and identify with. Hopefully we can continue these ideas in the 2014 festival. Cork, the rebel city, is the perfect place to do this. Cork is known as the rebel city. The people have an independent, passionate, rugged, free-thinking spirit, sympathy for the underdog, willingness to fight back. Where did Mary Harris get her views from, after all? There's an openness in some quarters in Cork to discuss and talk about new ideas. Cork's contribution to the Young Irelanders, Thomas Davis, Fenians, O'Donovan Rosa, founder of the Phoenix Society, from which the Fenians developed, the Land Wars, War of Independence, Michael Collins, we lost two Lord Mayors, was huge. It was the last place to fall in the subsequent Civil War, and Cork people made a vast contribution to building a modern Irish state. Its place in Irish games and the GAA is something we're proud of. They had just lost. People joke about flags which greet visitors to our city, where it's described as, quote, the People's Republic of Cork. However, to Cork people, they're no joke. It's really an attitude of mind, thought, and approach. We like our different approaches, but we welcome everyone to our city and county. And he goes on from there. And the enthusiasm was just so wonderful. So all I can do in concluding, talking a little about Mother Jones, is urge you all next summer to buy a ticket and go to Cork.
Folks, I hope you enjoyed Professor Elliot Gorn's take on Mary Harris, Mother Jones. It was a wonderful event here at Luxman Ireland House, NYU. We offer opportunities to hear speakers like Professor Elliot Gorn most Thursdays during the semester. So do be in touch with us or check out our website if you're interested in participating or becoming a member. Alas, we're coming to the end of the programme for this week. I'm Dr. Miriam Nyhan, and I want to thank you for listening to the Luxman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. I'll be back here again next Saturday, same time, on WNYE 91.5 FM and on www.irishradio.com. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me, my email address is ireland.house@nyu.edu, and our phone number here is 212-998-3950. If you'd like to hear Professor Gorn speak again, if you'd like to hear this program, please go to the website at www.irishradio.com. Stay tuned for the Adrian Flanelly Show, which is up next on irishradio.com, and we'll be here till noon, and on WVNJ 1160 AM. Thank you for listening to us. I'll be here hosting you again next Saturday, and our co-producer is Jamie Sweeney. Have a lovely weekend. Bye. Slán agus beannacht.